All right, we are back. I'm Nicole Sandler. It is RadioOrNot.com, and I'm very happy to welcome our next guest to the program. David Rolfe is the International Vice President of the Service Employees International Union, SEIU. He's the president of SEIU Local 775 and is the author of a new book that, I just realized we don't have sound on YouTube here a second. And he's the author of the new book called The Fight for 15. Good morning, David Rolfe, and welcome to the program.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for coming on. I should mention the second part of the title of the book is The Right Wage for a Working America. And it is. Today, the book actually comes out, is officially released a week from tomorrow. But today is a huge day in the fight for 15 as New York Governor Andrew Cuomo and California Governor Jerry Brown today both sign legislation into law making $15 the minimum wage in the two largest states in the country. Yes?
That's right. It's awesome news for workers today in America as our two largest states slowly raise their wage to $15 an hour, covering more than, I think, between California and New York and all the cities that have now gone to 15 or a similarly high wage. 14 million Americans are going to be getting a pay raise.
Now, you know, it used to be, and I'm a child of the 60s, basically. When I was a kid, a lot of high schoolers got minimum wage jobs to, you know, so we had spending money. Back then, though, the entire, our job situation was very different. Back in say, the 70s, when I was in high school, we could live in one income households. It was easy or at least accessible for a family to earn one income, have a middle class life, right? Everything has changed over the ensuing 40 years, hasn't it?
Yeah, that's exactly right. What we've seen is really a 40-year war on workers and the middle class in the U.S. I mean, just imagine if this were the 1976 presidential election. Mm-hmm. And a candidate gave a speech that said, you know, we're going to see the Berlin Wall come down. We're going to see American workers be as productive as ever. We're going to create industries that will create more wealth in the next 30 years than has been created in all of human history. But we're going to give all that wealth or 95% of it to the top 1%. We're going to ask the bottom 50% to take a pay cut. And the net economic impact of women doubling their workforce participation will be $0 in take-home pay for the bottom 90% of income earning households. No one would have voted for that presidential candidate. That's exactly what we got in this country.
Mm-hmm. No, it is. And you know, again, I'm going back. Let's go back to the 90s. During the 90s was a great decade, certainly for me. It was the decade that I got to the point that we all strive for, where you do better than your parents, right? You want each subsequent generation to be able to do better, to provide for their children better than their parents did for them. And I was on that road in the 90s, and then everything sort of fell apart in the early 2000s. For me, it was with the dot-com bust, and then I was getting back on my feet again in 2008, and then the George W. Bush, I think, recession or depression happened. And when the jobs came back, they came back at a fraction of the salaries that they had been before. Is it possible for a family, any family, to survive on one income these days?
Well, not if you're a low-wage worker. Right now, about 50% of Americans make less than $17 an hour. About 43% make less than $15 an hour. A third that make less than $10 an hour. There's no way in any major metropolitan area in this country that you can afford to raise a family or even be self-sufficient yourself on such low wages.
Right.
And to your point about our history, I think that's exactly right. You know, in my own family, my great-grandparents were agricultural and industrial workers. My grandparents were industrial workers with strong unions. My parents were white-collar professionals. And in our family history, every generation got to look their kids in the eye and say, you're going to have it better than I had it. But our generation, also a child of the 60s, is the one who gets to witness it all be thrown in reverse.
Yes.
And 200 years of progress be intentionally reversed in the service of trickle-down economics.
It really is. And so it's with our generation. I'm looking at my kids saying, one, I don't think I can send her to college like my parents did for me. And two, I'm not able to give her the things they gave me, and it's killing me. So I'm finding my way in a new economy and a new media landscape because, again, my industry was destroyed. In addition to when the jobs came back, they came back at much lower salaries. Technology added on to the, you know, the consolidation in radio that came from the Telecommunications Act, thank you, Bill Clinton, made my industry just a completely different landscape than it was, you know, when I graduated from college with a degree in broadcasting. So, you know, where a lot of us are having to sort of forge new territory when it comes to the industries that maybe in some cases, like me, we've worked in for decades. It's a whole new landscape. How does SEIU help us navigate this? Maybe that's too big a question to ask.
Well, it's the workers with strong unions are clearly at an advantage in this economy, just like they were in my grandfather's economy. Mm-hmm. People talk about the cost of union dues, which is maybe about $30 a month, but the non-union dues are thousands of dollars a year in lost income when workers don't realize their full earning potential by somewhat equalizing their bargaining relationship with their companies. But you get to a bigger point than just what good is a union or what good is SEIU going to do. There really is, at this moment, a need for a profound shift in our social fabric as a country and a real need for a social movement around the value of work. And the Fight for 15, which SEIU has helped lead nationally, is really the most salient expression of that at this moment. As we see, you know, tens of thousands of workers in hundreds of cities mobilized to demand 15 in a union, there is something happening in this country now. I write about it in the book, the fact that, you know, the official story has been the decline of unions. But over the last 20 years, there have been lots of exciting, innovative efforts at worker organizing and new forms of worker power emerging. And the Fight for 15 is probably the biggest and most important of those.
Well, let's talk about that then and how it came to be. And in the larger scale, I want to talk about SEIU because it seems like, I don't know, maybe a decade or so, it seems to have come out of nowhere. Now, I remember first hearing about the SEIU in the news when you guys took on the University of Miami. I'm in South Florida, and the janitors' mm-hmm. union. That was a big mm-hmm. deal. And then all of a sudden, I couldn't, everywhere I turned, I heard about SEIU. How long have you guys been around?
Well, SEIU's actually been around for almost a century. We were founded as an international union in 1921. And our founders were Chicago immigrant flat janitors, the people who cleaned and maintained residential buildings in Chicago. And those were the first SEIU members. And so that we really grew significantly in the 80s, the 90s, the 2000s, and some of those signature campaigns, like the Justice for Janitors campaign that you're referring to, mm-hmm. with home care organizing campaigns, really increased our membership significantly. I think gave new life to our union as we added hundreds of thousands of low-wage workers who are now really the heart and soul of this organization.
Right. So, again, I think maybe for me, University of Miami janitors strike and the victory won by SEIU brought you guys into the forefront, and then I saw you everywhere. When the Fight for 15 began, SEIU was the one who stood up. I mean, I remember first talking with my friend Greg Basta, who was then working for an organization called New York Communities of Change, and they helped organize one of the first fast food protests in New York. And so over the course of the last, 3, 4, 5 years, I've seen this thing grow and take on new life to where today, how awesome is this? Governors of New York and California are signing a $15 minimum wage into law. And tomorrow, the presidential primary will be held in Wisconsin, which really is ground zero for organized labor in this country, isn't it?
Yeah. You know, Wisconsin certainly has been one of the signals of the decline of traditional unions and collective bargaining rights. What's happening in places like New York and California today, I think, are the signals of what the future looks like for worker movements. Because as you point out, it wasn't just that we were lucky enough to wake up with the right politicians and they somehow decided to do this for America. This is something that America has made our politicians do for us. And the start really was that day in Brooklyn mm-hmm. when about 200 fast food workers organized with SEIU and the New York Communities for Change to walk off the job. Now, 200 people isn't necessarily a lot, but it was the largest fast food job action that anyone could remember in American history. And it became the spark.
Yeah.
That really gave rise to a series of strikes around the Midwest that spring. They landed in Seattle May. And at the same time, SeaTac airport workers were organizing for 15 and a union. And then in August of 2013, workers in over 60 cities going on strike for the first time demanding 15 and a union. And, this movement, which didn't really exist in as early as Labor Day of 2012, has now accelerated to the point where it's impacting tens of millions of American lives and making the country better.
Right. And the fact of the matter is, and you would have more facts and figures on this than I, all I can go by is sort of anecdotal evidence. It seems that on the rare occasion that I go through a fast food drive through to get a drink or something, I notice that they're not kids working there anymore. As I mentioned, when I was a kid, we'd supplement our you know, allowance by taking a minimum wage job. Now, a lot of adults are having to get fast food jobs just because of the way things are. And they're having to use that salary, that pay to take care of their families. What will the impact? Do I have that right? Is the majority of fast food workers now adults?
Right. About 88% are adults, and the average age is about 35. About a quarter of them are moms.
Okay, so they're adults.
About another quarter are over the age of 40.
Wow.
So this is no longer jobs for teenagers. And, you know, when my mother was in college in the late 50s and early 60s, she could work a minimum wage job, in her case, at a distillery in just outside of Cincinnati, Ohio, as a clerical worker for the summer, work for 7 weeks, and make enough money to pay her her public college tuition for the entire year. That's an economy we can't even remember or touch anymore.
Right.
Today, the vast majority of low-wage workers are at the age where most of us are imagining we should be buying homes, starting families. But instead, people are, you know, the stories that we talk about in the book and that we heard on the Seattle fast food campaigns were really incredible. 35-year-old single mom sharing a bunk bed in a 55-degree basement with their own children. People working two or three jobs, people with hundreds of thousands of dollars of debt from college they could not seem to ever pay off. And this economy that's really producing far more low-wage jobs than it is jobs for the supposedly high-tech, high-skilled jobs of the future. Right now, about three of every four jobs being created is a low-wage job that requires a high school education or less.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we hear these often right-wing economists, politicians, and think tanks sort of point their finger at American workers and say, it's your fault, you need more skills, they're actually, I mean, more skills is always a good thing to have, and it's obviously an awesome thing personally and educationally to have a degree or an advanced degree. But right now, about a third of Americans have college degrees, and only 20% of our jobs require them. The kinds of jobs that are growing fastest right now are home care worker, child care worker, day laborer, mover, driver, retail clerk.
Wow.
And these are all jobs that pay less than $15 an hour.
But not for too much longer, we hope. But not enough. The way the cost of living has increased, but our wages haven't, even $15 an hour, by the time, and again, it's not like these new minimums go into effect tomorrow. They're phased in gradually, because even though I don't think a $15 minimum wage is going to kill many small businesses, if you enacted them overnight, they would. So they're phased in gradually, but by the time we get there, if we don't fix all that, you know, the ills of the world, we're still going to be at a deficit, aren't we? We're going to be screaming, you know, fight for 22, won't we?
Well, we should. Well, $15 represents what I think the best minds thought was the most progressive edge of the possible back in 2012 when this campaign began. But one of the things I talk about in the book is that wages aren't enough. It's the simplest, fastest thing we can change, right? As we see, you know. I'm not sure that either of these governors necessarily ran for office a couple of years back planning on running leading a $15 wage campaign in their state legislatures. What got them to do that was workers sitting down, sitting in, going on strike, protesting, raising their voices, and really creating a social movement that the politicians couldn't ignore. But one of the things that I also talk about in the book is that wages aren't enough. We have to rethink retirement policy in this country. We have to rethink how we think about child care and early education. We have to think about our social safety net and our employment contract in some new ways if we're going to be ready for the 21st century.
Without a doubt.
Just the cost of long-term care alone for the aging baby boomers is itself an impending crisis. So wages are the simplest, fastest, and most important policy change we can make. But everything from criminal justice reform to immigration reform to trade policy to monetary policy really needs to be re-engineered with the specific goal of building and sustaining a strong American middle class.
So we're speaking with David Rolfe. He is the international vice president of SEIU, also president of SEIU Local 775. That's in the Seattle-Tacoma area, right? Where, if I remember correctly, SeaTac, which is the area surrounding the airport, was the first in the nation to say $15 an hour minimum wage. How has that gone there?
Well, SeaTac passed its living wage policy via ballot measure in 2013. You're right. It was the first time in the country we'd seen a broad $15 wage policy. Seattle was the second, a much larger city just to the north. But you asked about SeaTac. Let's talk about that for a second.
Okay.
Because during the campaign, the general manager of a luxury hotel in SeaTac called a meeting to campaign against Prop 1. And he said, if this passes, I might not be able to afford to give my employees free shift meals anymore. And some days that's the only meal they get. So here's a guy who runs a luxury hotel admitting that he pays his employees too little to eat, and then predicting that this would have the minimum wage increase would have some sort of unintended negative consequences. Well, after it passed, his investors met and they decided that they were going to double the size of this hotel, break ground on a new wing that includes two presidential suites and a luxury spa. Right down the street, a guy who runs a Master Park parking franchise, where you can park your car while you travel at the airport, said, well, if this passes, I'm just going to replace my employees by kiosks. After it passed, he admitted to the Washington Post and the Seattle Times that his customers really expect customer service, and he hung a big sign on his fence that says, now hiring $15 an hour.
Wow.
There is, simply put, the sky has not fallen. In fact, quite the reverse. We see lower turnover, lower employee mm-hmm. training costs because of that lower turnover. The taxpayers alone are probably saving $1 million every year in SeaTac because those workers are now they don't need to go on Medicaid for their health care.
Right.
And, generally speaking, we looked at everything that the right wing has predicted and the business lobby has predicted about minimum wage increases since they started, since the first federal minimum wage in 1937.
Mm-hmm.
And they're always wrong. Not only is it generally not true that employment goes down when wages go up, it's never happened a single time. When you look at the federal minimum wage increases through the years, 82% of them correlated with an increase in jobs, about 18% of them correlated with no change in jobs, and 0% of them correlated with any job loss. The same was true when you looked at the early cities to do higher minimum wages, San Francisco, Santa Fe, Albuquerque. They generally gained jobs faster than their surrounding communities, and then during the following recession, lost jobs more slowly.
Mm-hmm.
So when we look at everything from the unintended consequences argument about job loss or whether there's going to be an impact on business growth, I suppose it's theoretically possible that if you suddenly jumped the minimum wage to $30 or $40, that might happen. But there simply has never been a minimum wage increase in the history of the country that has caused any of those dire predictions to really come true.
But, and again, of course, the people who earn minimum wage they spend every dollar that comes in. It's the fastest way to put a stimulus into the economy is give the minimum wage workers more money to spend because they spend it.
When you
give the wealthiest more money, they hoard it.
That's exactly right. Of all of the money that's going into workers' pockets in Seattle because of our increased minimum wages, about $0 is going to offshore tax savings. Almost none of it to Swiss bank accounts,
yep.
and very little of it to speculating on the stock market.
Most of it's
getting spent in the local community where people buy school supplies, buy pharmaceuticals, fix the broken dryer, fix the leaky roof, get out of debt, go to the dentist for the
buy
first time.
Buy a pair of pants.
Years.
Right. Go to a movie even. Right.
Exactly. Right. Well, I said to the CEO of an airline once, wouldn't it be awesome if the people putting fuel in your jets could afford to buy a ticket on one of them?
Yeah. No kidding. No kidding. Okay. So, look, I'm with you 100%. We need this. This is a great day. New York and California, the rest of the country should follow. And it's one thing that uniformly polls high, raising the minimum wage. Doesn't matter what party those being polled are in. Everybody, or almost everybody, agrees that this is the way to go. It is, and as studies tell us, you raise the minimum wage, the economy is stimulated, more people have more money to spend, and it goes from there.